Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. Just over a year ago, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson made a declaration of war against coronavirus. "We are engaged in a war against this disease, which we have to win," he told a Downing Street press conference as the UK was locked down for the first time. US President Donald Trump echoed the analogy, calling the virus an invisible enemy, but assuring American citizens, "We are going to win." His successor, Joe Biden, followed suit. The language of war offers the politician and their followers something paradoxical: security. War is familiar to us. Take the war on drugs or the war on obesity. These phrases give us control over the unknown. They allow us to believe we are taking united action against an identifiable enemy, us versus them. I've often wondered if the imagery of war goes deeper to the core of how human societies are organized. The Prussian military strategist Karl von Clausewitz once argued that war was a continuation of politics by other means. But perhaps the politics of regular elections is simply war by other means. Parties fighting with words rather than swords. From football matches to business meetings, the language and imagery of war pervades us. The question raised is a disturbing one. Is war fundamental to our lives? It's a question Margaret Macmillan, professor of history at the University of Toronto and fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, attempts to answer in her new book, War: How Conflict Shaped Us. Professor Macmillan has distinguished herself as an historian of international relations and the history of empire. She is author of, among others, Women in the Raj, A History of Women in British India, The War That Ended Peace, A History of the First World War, and Paris 1919, 6 Days That Changed the World, on the Paris Peace Conference, for which Macmillan won the prestigious Samuel Johnson Prize. And she's with me now to discuss. Margaret, perhaps you can help me with an answer here. A key idea in your book, and one you've discussed widely elsewhere, is this idea that war is actually the norm in human society, and peace is the anomaly. War is not an aberration, you write, nor is it simply an absence of peace, which is really the normal state of affairs. So tell me, how deep does our relationship with war go? Does it structure our consciousness and gear us for seeing the world in terms of conflict?
I think war is very much a part of human society, and I think it's shaped a lot of what we do, a lot of our institutions, a lot of the ways we think about things. I think if a lot of us think that war is an aberration, it is probably because we have lived in countries which haven't experienced war. I mean, a lot of us have been extremely fortunate and have enjoyed what people are now calling the long peace since 1945. I'm a Canadian, and Canada has been involved in wars, but they've been overseas. And so Canadians have not experienced war firsthand in their own country. And that's true of a lot of people in the developed world. And so I think it's become possible for us to assume that our particular experience in the years since 1945 is the norm. Yet if we look at the past, war seems to me to be so deeply woven into human history. It's impossible to think of a century or part of the world that hasn't experienced war. And as we know, war is still happening around the world in a great many countries. And it's been estimated that there's been a war pretty much everywhere in the world, pretty much every year since 1945. And so I think war exists. Why it exists is a huge debate about that. But I think it exists partly because people in control of groups or states think that they can use it. They see it as a tool that they can use to gain something they want. And I define war quite narrowly, actually, as organized violence by an organized group.
Yeah. In what way is war different from fighting, say, between gangs or tribes? Yeah. And when can we say war enters human historical consciousness as a distinct idea, you think?
Well, I think war uses violence, and it uses fighting, it uses combat between individuals. And of course, we all know that you can have individuals or even small groups of individuals who will fight each other. They brawl at football matches, for example, or they might brawl outside a pub. But I don't consider that war. That war will use that sort of violence, but war is more purposive. And war reflects a higher degree of organization and a higher degree of clear goals. How far back it goes, of course, is difficult to tell because there have been humans on this planet for a very long time. But as far as we can tell from the evidence, from archaeological evidence, and then, of course, in the beginnings of written history and the beginnings of the making of artifact, human beings have been organizing themselves into groups and have been battling with other groups. As soon as we settled down, I think, and again, of course, there's much debate about this, but once we settled down and became agriculturalists, we developed a higher degree of social organization. We began to form bigger and bigger groups. And of course, it became more difficult for us to pick up and leave if somebody attacked us. It also became easier, perhaps, for us to attack others.
But how organized does violence need to be in order to be called war? What is the level of organization in your mind?
Well, there's always going to be a blurred line between, say, gangs fighting each other or mobs fighting each other. But it seems to me what distinguishes war, and we should think about it in this way, is the level of organization. I think what war requires is a high degree of organization. It uses violence, but violence isn't the key thing about war. I think, myself, the key thing about war is organization. An anthropologist I was talking to said to me once, and I've always remembered it, war is the most organized of all human activities. And I think he's got something there.
And of course, this then also has to do with the causes of war. And you identify three which crop up in almost all conflicts. It's greed for resources or power, fear and ideology, emotions and ideas. So let's talk about the last one. How did ancient societies convince their subjects to fight for them?
Well, convincing people to fight actually takes a good deal of effort. I mean, that's one of the reasons that the military do so much training. I mean, we are not, I think, naturally predisposed towards violence. We may lash out when we're afraid, but I think we're also predisposed towards altruism. We're predisposed towards working with each other. And so I think what war does and what those who make war do is take people and make them into warriors. They do it through culture. They do it through training. I think this is very important. I mean, there may be biological impulses that feed into us using violence and making war. But I think myself that culture and political organization and direction is enormously important.
Yeah, and the question of that basically that violence may come natural as defense, but still in all kind of groups and settings, we tend to punish violence that is not acceptable or within the rules, so to speak. So that's an interesting sort of question that in ancient societies, we've been killing the people who've been too violent, for example.
Well, yes, and there's a very interesting debate going on among evolutionary biologists and psychologists and others that perhaps we're becoming less violent. I mean, you know, of course, Steven Pinker has written his famous book, The Better Angels of Our Nature.
Yeah.
In which he argues that we are less tolerant of violence than we used to be. And I think in a way, you know, I think he's got something. I mean, homicide rates, except in certain countries such as the United States, where they remain high, have gone down in most societies since, you know, the beginning of the 19th century. And we tolerate less public violence, I think, than we used to. There's a very interesting argument that a professor at Harvard, Charles Wrangham, makes, and that is that we have, in a sense, bred ourselves not to be violent, that the more violent men have had trouble finding mates, that they have tended to get themselves killed, and so that we may actually be becoming more domesticated and peaceable, rather like wolves gradually were domesticated into dogs.
But then at the same time, we've developed techniques and technology that makes war much more deadly. So there's a paradox there.
There is indeed, and this is what Wrangham's book is about. In fact, he calls it the goodness paradox. He says, as we have become, he would argue, nicer, more altruistic, less disposed towards violence, we've actually become better at war. And he makes this very important point, which I certainly believe in, that war is purposive. And we have become very good at making war to achieve things we want. And we may be nicer individually, but we still make war very, very effectively.
In the modern period, you chart the rise of ideologies such as nationalism, communism, and fascism, and their link to large-scale warfare. Again, what is that emotional link? How did these modern ideologies convince people that they were worth dying for, you think?
I think what the importance of an ideology is it makes you feel part of a group that has an existence outside of your particular existence. It has existed through time. It represents something timeless, and it will go on existing. And Benedict Anderson has this very important concept of the imagined community. It's a very powerful concept, and people are prepared to die for this community, which they never actually meet.
And it's interesting, well, civil wars are fascinating in that respect, because it's also that you suddenly, you have a community that suddenly falls apart and you start to see your neighbor as the enemy. What can we say about civil wars?
I think civil wars are among some of the bitterest wars. I mean, we know there are different kinds of wars. There are wars in which people will fight, and at the end they'll sort of make it up, or they'll simply coexist with each other. But civil wars are like a family fight. It's a betrayal of the unit. You don't forgive those who, as you see it, whatever side you're on, are breaking up the unit, who are destroying the unit to which you belong. And so the passions aroused in civil wars, I think, can be very powerful indeed, and the bitterness left by civil wars, as we know, can persist for generations.
What do we know about overcoming that bitterness, the aftermath of a civil war? We have quite a few examples from the 20th century.
Well, we have spent quite a bit of time trying to think about how we overcome the legacy and the bitterness of war. St. Augustine, and we've been doing this for a long time, St. Augustine said the object of war should be peace. And I think he was right. But we don't often think about it. And we have, I think, been trying very hard in the 20th and 21st centuries to try and think of ways of overcoming that legacy of war, because we know what it can lead to. And so we've been trying, for example, to have truth and reconciliation commissions, to try and write histories which reflect both sides or the different sides in a war, to try and remove some of the poisons which can continue to affect societies.
You quote Frederick Manning, the Australian poet who fought in and wrote about the Battle of the Somme. War, he says, is a crime against mankind, but also the punishment for a crime. But what did he mean by that?
I've wondered myself. I think what he means is we understand the first part of the statement, that war is a crime against humanity and dreadful things are done in its name. But it may also be punishing us for something in ourselves. Why do we fight wars? Why do we look at people who are very like us, and why do we see them as somehow being other? Why do we see them as somehow being less valid, less human than we are? And it seems to be something, again, that as far as we can tell, goes deep into the human past.
Yeah, and this also goes to the question if it's primarily cultural or something, you know, biological, I suppose, in the sense it's both, because, of course, fighting is fighting, and something happens in human beings when they go into a fight. But if, as you say, war is primarily culture, it seems that we can be civilized toward peace. So, and this goes back to the argument we just discussed, but you point to public opinion, for example, as a key factor in persuading modern states to wage war. But by the 1970s and the American War of Vietnam, public opinion becomes a net pacifying force. Today, it's also unlikely to find sort of zealous advocates of war in the West. So have we become psychologically more pacifist as a society?
I think it fluctuates. Some societies become more pacific, and then some societies become more warlike. And I think it depends what period you're talking about. I mean, European societies tended, many of them, to value militaristic values, to admire the military, and to fight to gain their ends. And yet it's unthinkable today, or pretty much unthinkable, that countries in Europe would fight each other. And I think there's been a really significant change in the way Europeans think about themselves, about others, and about whether they will fight or not. I think there's a huge cultural shift, but also a very important political shift.
How fast can societies develop in one direction or the other? That's an interesting question.
Well, I think we tend to think of societies getting more peaceable, and I think that's certainly the case in Europe and the case, for example, with Sweden or Switzerland, both of which produced quite ferocious soldiers up until about the 18th or even 19th centuries, but which now we see as peace-loving and peace-promoting countries. But I think you can see it going the other way. I mean, I think China's a very interesting example. I mean, the Chinese have a long tradition in warfare, but they have tended to regard warfare as a breakdown of other ways of doing things and better ways of doing things. And they've tended not to have a great admiration for great military heroes. I mean, the great heroes in classical Chinese society were the great civil servants, the great writers, the great thinkers. But I think possibly what we're seeing in China today is a permeation of military values militarism into Chinese society. So I think it is possible to see societies becoming less inclined to war or perhaps more inclined to war. I think, as I say, it depends on the time.
But if you take China as an example, so what has happened there that have changed that direction, you think?
I think it's partly what China has suffered in the 19th and 20th centuries. I mean, China has suffered, as the Chinese leadership themselves talk about it, a very bad century from the First Opium War until the final end of the Civil War in 1949. And it was invaded, it suffered civil war, it suffered tremendous loss of life. And I think more importantly, it suffered the collapse of a type of society and a very difficult and painful attempt to build a new society. And so I think China has become, although again, this is, like much in history, it's a matter of great debate, but I think China has become a rather different sort of society. And I think what's very interesting now is how the Chinese look at the Second World War, which they look at as a good war, and they look at it as a war in which China came together. And Chiang Kai-shek, who was the enemy in the end of the communists, is now being reevaluated as someone who was a Chinese patriot. And the Chinese nationalists are, you know, not fully admired, but they are seen as people who fought the Japanese and therefore are admirable. So I think China's attitude towards war, it seems to me, is shifting. And I think there's considerable admiration for what the Chinese did in the Second World War in resisting the Japanese.
The concept of humiliation often comes back when we talk about war and also sort of revenge. Does that play a part also in the Chinese view of their fate in the last two centuries?
I think it does. And I think it's also something the Chinese leadership very consciously use. You know, when a Western leader or Western powers criticize something in China, criticize, for example, the treatment of the Uyghur or the Tibetans, the Chinese response often is, we are fed up with imperialist powers telling us what to do. We've had enough of that. We've suffered enough of that. And so it can be instrumental as well as something deeply felt. It can be both.
Mm. If we look at the 20th century, of course, rules and conventions seems to be as much of a part of war as the technology that we have developed. Do rules and conventions work in controlling war, you would say?
It is a curious thing, isn't it? I mean, that war is violence, and it's about, you know, as Clausewitz, the great German military theorist, said, war is about an act of violence intended to compel your enemy to do your will. But at the same time, as we use violence, we are also trying to control it. I mean, and that goes back a long way, again, into human history. And so we've tried to say that you should only fight on certain days or in certain ways, and you should only attack certain people in certain ways. I mean, for example, the ancient Greeks had certain days when they didn't fight, during the Olympics, for example. In medieval Europe, the church tried to say, not always very successfully, but tried to say you shouldn't fight on Christmas Day or Easter or other holy days, and you shouldn't attack certain categories of people. You shouldn't attack merchants going about their business. You shouldn't attack women and children, and you shouldn't attack priests. And so I think, you know, this attempt to control war and to minimize its impact goes back a very long way, and we're still trying, and we don't always succeed, I'm afraid.
But the question is also, I wonder if some of the conventions and rules seems to be on a sort of a high level, while maybe the old honor rules of the soldier, etc., from earlier periods. I wonder what was most effective in basically in controlling the direct action on the ground.
It's a good question. I mean, I think the rules of honor only ever really applied if you felt you were fighting people like yourself. Mm-hmm. And so when aristocratic-led societies in Europe fought each other, the aristocrats tended to treat each other quite well. You know, there's that wonderful movie by Jean Renoir, Les Règles de Jeu, when an officer would give his word as an officer not to try and escape, and that was sort of understood. I mean, the parole, that's what it meant. The word parole meant that you gave your word of honor, and your word of honor was accepted. But Europeans who treated each other in this way would treat others in appalling ways. I mean, when they were fighting Muslims, for example, in the Crusades, they didn't extend the same rules towards them. And they didn't extend the same rules in the 19th century when they were building big empires towards those they were conquering.
In the controlling of war, around that theme about organization and organized violence, you have a fascinating discussion of the role of the state in war. War favors centralized powers, and from ancient Rome to the French monarchy, we've seen that. How important was war to the development of politics and state responsibilities? I mean, such as welfare, for example.
Well, the sociologist Charles Tilly has this famous saying, war made the state and the state made war. And I think he's really onto something. I think, you know, the more powerful the state, the more it can control the resources of society and get at those resources, and the more it can bring under control people who don't want to be part of the state or don't want to obey the central government, the more it needs to make war, the more it has to do this. And so it's a two-way process. The state becomes more powerful because of the need to make war. Because it becomes more powerful, it becomes better at extending its power and if it chooses, making war. And I think it's had a huge impact. I mean, the ways in which states have learnt to tax their own societies has often been driven by war. I mean, the British and the Dutch developed sinking funds. They developed the idea of national debts. They developed the idea of central banks. And this was, I think, very largely to finance their expensive wars.
No, so when we look now at the war on COVID, we can see how the government is using their powers in a quite strong way. Is this something that goes hand in hand to other wars?
Well, a great crisis will bring out or can bring out big responses. And that's where the COVID pandemic is rather like a war. I mean, it's not a war, and I don't think that language should be used, but it's rather like a war in which it demands huge government intervention. And we know that once governments have acquired powers, they can be rather reluctant to give them back. The income tax, for example, which was introduced before the First World War in the UK, but certainly became more important in the First World War, was something governments came to depend on. And certain measures of controls over societies, just to take perhaps a silly example, but during the First World War, the British government limited the hours that British pubs could remain open because they didn't want the factory workers who were making the materials needed for war, the munitions, for example, didn't want them to go and have, you know, too much to drink in the afternoon because they wouldn't work. And those licensing restrictions lasted well up, I believe, until the 1970s. And so I do think once measures are brought in to give governments greater strength, it's in power over society, governments can be a bit reluctant to undo them all.
Yeah, it's just like it's easy to raise taxes, but very hard to get rid of them. How did war, conversely, shape the idea of the citizen?
Well, it's, again, I think, a very interesting development. I mean, you were beginning to get the notion that people were no longer subjects, that they were the citizens of something called the nation. And I think you're beginning to get it towards the end of the 18th century in parts of Europe and in the United States, or what became the United States, as people begin to see themselves as having rightfully some control over who governed them. And when you begin to think like that, you're no longer a subject just doing what you're told or not really paying much attention to whoever is in charge because it doesn't really affect you, you don't have any say in it, to being someone who is part of this thing called the nation, and you're a citizen, which means you have a say, or should have a say in how that nation is governed and what that nation decides to do. And that, I think, is something that helped to make war a lot bigger in the 19th century, because if you're the citizen of a nation, you also have a converse, you have a corresponding obligation to defend that nation. And I think citizenship helped to spread the idea of nationalism, of belonging to this thing called the nation, which certainly was one of the ideologies that helped to fuel war.
And at the same time, you also have in war, you have on the one hand the government, you have the citizens who have to fight the war, but also we have private organizations. And I wonder a little bit about the role of private organizations in war. It is fascinating. They tend to cut across state boundaries. How has private money shaped war?
If you're thinking of the big arms manufacturers, they, of course, provide the materials that are needed for war, and what they want to do is sell them. And quite often, arms manufacturers have sold to all sorts of different sides. I mean, basically, arms manufacturers, like any other manufacturers, are in the business of making money. And if they can sell to someone who might be an enemy of their country one day, why not? You know, in the First World War, before the First World War, the Krupps, huge arms manufacturers in Germany, sold the, or helped to sell the fortifications and defenses of the Belgian frontier forts, such as Liège. And at the same time sold the German army the guns that would knock those fortresses to smithereens. And so, yes, I think the search for profits, as we know, is transnational and can cross boundaries. But, of course, when a war comes, governments try very hard to ensure that the manufacture of arms stays in the country and only benefits their own forces.
And of course, then you have the history of mercenaries who can be more or less organized. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, there have always been those who have set themselves out to fight as soldiers, often because they don't really have many other choices in life. I mean, if you come from a poor part of Europe, for example, as was true of the Swiss mercenaries, the Scots who became mercenaries, the Irish who became mercenaries, the Poles who became mercenaries in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, you didn't have many options before you. If you came from a poor part of the world, if you were a young man with any energy, being a mercenary was an attractive option. And it offered at least the hope, if you didn't get yourself killed, of gaining some wealth, possibly even gaining a wife or a partner. And so mercenaries have been with us for a very long time. And of course, we have to accept the fact that they're those who like fighting. And we're seeing mercenaries again today. I mean, there are a number now of private security companies. Yeah. Which are providing people who, it's said for security, but who will fight if necessary.
And of course, also, as you said, war and armies has always been a way for people who come from poor backgrounds to make sometimes an excellent career. But there's more to it than just the money. Of course, it's the excitement. Can you tell us a little bit about the life of soldiers and also why war is attractive to many people?
I think, and it's something we find difficult to deal with, that for some people, war is attractive. It has a sort of glamour. It has an excitement. I mean, it's not different, I think, that much from the same impulse that makes people want to ski very fast down hills or snowboard very fast down hills or ride motorcycles very fast. They know that they might be risking their lives, but that gives it an added excitement. And of course, what war also does is give people the chance to become more powerful, to become more important. I think the man with the gun, it is often the man with the gun, can throw his weight around, can take things he wants because no one's going to be able to stand up to him. And so I think you do have people who find going off to make war very attractive. I mean, again, as with the mercenaries today, I mean, they are choosing to do it.
When we look at first-hand accounts, historical sources of young men that goes to war, are there any sort of patterns we can see in how people tend to describe their experience?
I think it depends very much on what sort of war they're in. But one thing that comes out a lot, I think, is this concern that a number of those who go to war that they may not be brave enough, they may not match up. That testing themselves, I think, is something that often comes out. And what also comes out is the reasons people fight. People will fight for a cause, but once they're in a war, they'll often fight for their comrades. A number of the war memoirs, many of them say, the people who I fought with, I was prepared to die for, and they were prepared to die for me. And that is not something you get a lot of the time in civilian life. And I think it's very important. I mean, the comradeship comes out. And you will get, I mean, I've talked to soldiers about this who say, I don't like to talk about it, but there is a sort of excitement when you're actually in a battle situation, when you might actually know that you'll get it going into battle or someone's firing at you. And it's a very intense experience. And it's really unlike most other things in life. It's not that they revel in it, but it just is a very different sort of experience. And some of them remember it. They say, I felt very intensely alive just when I thought I was about to get killed.
And is it common that people want to go back into battle when they experience it, that it becomes a drug?
I suspect it does. I mean, I think you get the same thing with war correspondents. It's sort of a well-known phenomenon that war correspondents, war photographers, get sort of hooked on the adrenaline of being a correspondent. Not all, but a number of them have said later, I sort of missed it when I wasn't there. And I think the fact that so many of those who have fought, I mean, take the period after the First World War, a lot of demobilized soldiers went off to join volunteer groups. In Germany, you got the Freikorps, people who had come out of the war alive and who volunteered to join these bands, which went off and fought around the frontiers of Germany in the Baltics, for example. And I think it was, there was something to it. I mean, I don't know if there's a very good movie, which I thought a very good movie, called The Hurt Locker, about a man who did bomb disposal, which is one of the most dangerous things you can be doing. And he decides, he's going to come back to his wife and child in the United States, try and patch things up, and he can't stand it. I mean, it's not the problem with his wife and child. It's civilian life. And he goes back and he starts disposing of bombs again.
Yeah, it's interesting because on the one hand, we have the sort of these experiences. We have also first-hand accounts. We have, of course, the movies about what has shaped the way we think about it. And then we have, as you mentioned, the war correspondents. They're hugely important, of course, for the way we see war through our news media. But then we have us, the historians, looking back at past conflict and trying to make sense of them. And I sometimes think, you know, yeah, Tucydides, Machiavelli, Clausewitz, the list of great thinkers that have been writing on the subject goes on. Why is it necessary to keep studying war? What is it there's to still discover?
Oh, I think there's a lot to discover. I mean, there are some areas that are very well studied. Technology has been pretty well studied, although not everywhere at all times. Wars in non-European countries haven't been studied that much. I mean, I was very surprised to find out how little there was on Chinese warfare and Japanese warfare, certainly at least translated into English, that I think certain cultures haven't really examined, or we haven't examined the wars of certain cultures all that much. And there's some things that really, I think, need a lot more research: gender and war. Why is it that so many of those who have fought, why is it the huge majority of those who fought have been men? Why haven't women participated in the same way?
What is your answer?
Again, I think it's a toss-up between biology and culture, and I'd say it's probably a mix of both, but more likely culture. I mean, it's been argued that women biologically are the nurturers, they bear the children, and therefore they don't have the same aggressive tendencies as men, and men are the warriors. But we know that when women do fight, they can fight as ferociously, as good or badly, as men can fight. And I suspect it's more culture, that for so much of history, societies have been patriarchal. Women have been expected to occupy a certain position. Men have been expected to occupy a certain position. And women as warriors has been frowned upon. You know, there have been examples of women warriors, and they've usually been regarded with horror as somehow freaks, as not proper women. In the Second World War, you know, there were a very famous squadron or more of Russian women pilots, bomber pilots, and the Germans called them the Night Witches. You know, they saw them as unnatural women.
And then at the same time, you have the Valkyrias, of course, you have the Amazons, but that seems maybe to be, as you point out in your book also, there's sort of an idealization of an unnatural woman. So they're not seen as typical women in a sense. Am I right in that?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's now fairly well established, I think, that there really were women warriors at the basis of the Amazon myth. But the Greeks certainly treated the myth of Amazons with something, I would argue, with horror. I mean, this was so unnatural, these women. It's a bit the same way that we've treated powerful women rulers. You know, there's been something a bit odd about them. That also, so history has said, you know, Catherine the Great, you know, she was really a bit odd. Elizabeth I of England, you know, a bit odd. The Empress Wu in China, you know. So I do think I think this is a very cultural construction.
Do you have any good research on how men and women handle the experience of war? If they handle it differently, do they tell different stories afterwards?
Well, there's not much evidence so far, but there's a very interesting book by Svetlana Alexievich, the Belarusian writer who won the Nobel Prize, called "The Unwomanly Face of War," and she interviewed all these women who'd gone to war, and most of them didn't want to talk about it, which can happen to men as well. But most of them said they wanted to put it behind them, that people, when they came home, didn't want to hear about it because they felt what the women had been doing was unnatural and something they should be ashamed of. And whether that is, again, cultural or biological, I don't think we'll ever know. But it may be that women do process war in different ways than men do and do think about it differently afterwards. But why that should be so, I think we need a lot more research.
Mm. Going back to the centralization of power for the purposes of war, it raises a fundamental challenge. We often describe war in terms of structural factors, so resources, geopolitics, social movements. But how should historians account for personality in modern war? Should charismatic generals and rebel leaders still have a place in our accounts?
Well, I think they always will, because I think we're fascinated by the sort of great figures. And clearly, I think you do get individuals who can make a difference. Well, to begin with, you get statesmen who will use war, for example, like Bismarck did, as he used war to unify the German states into the modern state of Germany. And so I think we could argue that without Bismarck, And without his skill at both provoking the wars he wanted and bringing them to an end when he'd got what he wanted, the outcome might have been very different. We might not have seen a united Germany, or not in the same way. And there are generals, I think, who do make a difference. But I think we can exaggerate just how much. I mean, without the resources and without the men to fight, and without sometimes a lot of luck, even the best of generals can't do that much. I mean, I think it was Napoleon's great luck that he came of age at a time when his career suddenly became possible as a general, thanks to the French Revolution, which it wouldn't have been. He wouldn't have risen as far and as fast as he did without the French Revolution. And he also found himself at the head of probably the richest country in Europe, and a country that was united, or at least more united than some of its neighbors, by a feeling of nationalism. And so, you know, if he'd been a great general in a very small country, he wouldn't have been able to do as much. And so it's a combination of the individual, the timing, the luck, and the resources that individual will have or not have.
That is, of course, a question that Machiavelli is preoccupied with and fascinated by, and Fortuna, basically. And he says that, well, to paraphrase, it's basically 60-40. He says that 40% is what you can control and the rest is luck. Would you agree with Machiavelli on that description?
Yes, I think I would. I mean, I think the more we look at, for example, the very successful German attack on France in 1940, luck comes into it. You know, the Germans took a tremendous gamble. And if one or two river crossings had gone differently as they were coming into France, they might have slowed down, they might have been counterattacked by the French, and that invasion might have turned up very differently. So no, I think luck can often play a part.
I would like to end on how we should remember war and remembrance, but in order to talk about that, one also has to sort of acknowledge the atrocities of war, and how should we explain it? You raised the example of the massacre of Oradour-sur-Glane, a French village in June 1944 by the Waffen-SS troops, without reason. And there's, of course, a classic example also of the Auschwitz prison guard. What is going through their minds? How should we understand these atrocities?
I don't know. I think understanding evil is very difficult, and it's something theologians have been grappling with for centuries. I think we have to keep trying to understand. I mean, I think one of the great puzzles about what happened with German troops, not just in the SS, but in other branches of the German armed forces as well, is how apparently ordinary men who were kind fathers and husbands, who, you know, were kind to others, became people who could kill without apparently any remorse whatsoever, and kill children the same age as their own children, kill old people, kill people who had never done anything to them. And I think it's something we have to keep puzzling about, because it is, alas, a part of human nature, and we have to keep trying to understand it, what makes people do these things.
So war then brings in both the best and the worst in humanity. So the role of remembrance in modern society is under increasing scrutiny. Why do you think this is? What role does remembrance serve in our understanding of war?
Well, remembrance is about who we are and how we think about the past, and it's always going to be debated, because we change, and how we think about the past is going to change, and how we perceive the past is going to change. You know, the commemoration of the First World War, for example, has changed significantly over the decades in a number of the countries that fought. The Russians remember it not that much, or they don't care to remember it because they remember the Second World War. The British used to remember the First World War as a war of triumph, of victory. That was certainly how it was often commemorated in the 1920s. By the 1930s, they were beginning, as they became more and more apprehensive about a second war, they were beginning to see it as a bad war, a war that didn't settle anything. And so the ways in which wars are commemorated will change depending on the circumstances of society. Sometimes commemorations will be used by governments for their own purposes, to elevate their own people to a particular status, to talk about the glories of the past, to try and inculcate a sense of patriotism. My own sense about remembering war is we should remember it as an affliction that affects winners and losers alike. And what I find encouraging is when Germans, French, and British, for example, got together to commemorate the beginning of the First World War, I thought, you know, there is a time when commemoration must go beyond just our side and must bring in everyone who was in the war.
Margaret Macmillan, thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.